During the past 2 years, which is amazing to think about, we've been having this class for 2 years and 3 months. We've covered several topics and worked through several arguments showing the existence of God, right? To be very probable and even in some cases necessary. So, for instance, we've covered the cosmological argument, showing that there is a beginning to the universe and how that shows that there is a God. We've also covered the teleological argument, showing that there's design and purpose to the universe and how that leads to the existence of God. And we've also gone over the moral argument, so showing that moral values and duties point to there being a creator, a God. And there's many others that some we have covered and some we haven't. There's many other arguments to show that God exists. And not many gods. We're talking about just one God existing. And that's key because what happens is, obviously, you have a ton of different religions these days, right? And some of them definitely teach that there's multiple gods. So you have Mormonism being one of them. And then Hinduism, where there's millions of gods. But with these arguments we've gone over the past couple years is, okay, we're actually just down to one God, right? So what necessarily that means is that these other polytheistic religions have to be false. And so what that leaves us with are just three core monotheistic religions, meaning the religions that believe that there's only one God. Does anybody know what the three are, the three major religions that are monotheistic?
Judaism,
Christianity, and one more,
Islam.
Yep, with Allah being one, right? So, yeah, and so that actually helps us and really any other seeker of the truth to kind of, hey, if you're thinking, which religion is true? These arguments really help us narrow down our scope. So now we only have to look at three different religions and say, okay, well, what separates these two? And they can't all be right. Because they each have their own claims about reality, which contradict one another. So they can't all be right. But that means that if one of them is true, then the others are false, by definition. That leaves us with the monotheistic religions, and they can't all be right. But if one is true, that means the other two are false. And now we have a question. Well, we know that because of the moral argument, there is a God who is personal, and also because of the cosmological argument, we know that this God is not kind of just an impersonal force like Star Wars or something like that, but this God is personal, and he wants to relate to us, to his creation. But then also that goes to show that there's a purpose in the design, in his creation. And so if this God wanted to reveal himself to us, how would that happen, right? So if, for instance, we know already that God reveals himself, at least by reading the Bible, right? We know that God reveals himself through creation and conscience, right? So Romans chapter 1, and this might be a good thing. I know this was on the study guide. How does God reveal himself already to his creation? Romans chapter 1, verse 20. Paul wrote, "Since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So that means everybody on this earth who has ever lived, we already should know that there is a God, just based on what we see in creation. And that's one of the ways that God reveals himself to us. And this revelation is known as general revelation. So this is just, think of the word, what general means. It's just broad. It just means that kind of everybody gets this revelation. It's in creation. So everybody sees it. Everybody has a concept of it. So it's general revelation. And notice, if you think about it, when you look at nature, it gives you some information about God, but it doesn't give you the whole picture. So when I look at creation, I know that there's a God. I know that there's a powerful God, right? Because we know from creation it came from nothing. So it has to be immensely powerful. I also know that this God has some sort of moral purpose, right? So when we see creation, when we see wrong being occurring, we know that there's something off with that. So we know that, yeah, there's got to be something greater. There has to be a standard. But for instance, we wouldn't know if this God is just one person or three persons, right? We don't know if it's the triune God or anything like that, not necessarily. So it only gives us a basic idea. Creation only gives us a basic idea about God's existence and his attributes. So the question is, well, how would we get a more detailed understanding about God's purposes and God's attributes? Well, this is where miracles come in, okay? An illustration which is used in this book right here, which I would encourage everybody, if you get a chance, it's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Norman Geisler and Frank Turek. If you're a Kindle reader, it's usually on sale, $5.99, or sometimes it goes down to $3.99, so it's really cheap. Pick it up, really good information. But on their chapter on miracles, he uses this illustration of a king's seal. All right, so think of ancient times and how a king's seal was used. So it goes like this. Before mass communication, obviously, like email and UPS and anything, communications were sent by hand, right? And a king, when he would send a message, he would place a seal on that message. Now, this seal would be a sign to the recipient of the message that the message was authentic, meaning it really came from the king and not someone trying to pose as the king, right? But now, in order to make this seal system work, the seal had to be unusual or unique, right? Not some common image or something like that. It had to be easily recognizable. And also, it had to be something that only the king possessed. That's the word I was missing. So not something that everybody else just had lying around. Oh, I can make a seal right out of this, right? So it seems to me then that when we consider miracles, if we consider this analogy with the king's seal, it seems that miracles kind of fit into this category of if God wanted to reveal, remember, we have three religions to choose from right now. If a God wanted to reveal his purposes and his attributes to his creation, it seems that miracles would do the job of giving a more detailed understanding of who God is and what his purposes are. And so miracles fit the category of being unusual, unique. They're easily recognizable. So when you witness a miracle, you're like, yeah, that was a miracle, right? And it's also something only God can do. It's not something that anybody else can replicate or even come close to replicating, right? Miracles seem to fit this bill. And what's interesting, though, is when you talk to a skeptic, and I've had this happen before, is usually when I ask them, okay, well, just for argument's sake, what would it take for you, Mr. Skeptic, to believe in God? And usually a response is like, well, if God performed some miracle, if God wrote in the sky, I am God, I exist, then I might consider believing in God. So even the skeptic is ready to admit that it would take a miracle for them to believe in God. So they have a concept of what a miracle would look like. Now, of course, the rub is that they dismiss miracles automatically for other reasons, and we'll talk about that. But even they admit, if a miracle were to occur, yeah, that would make me consider. So now, keep that in mind, right? The whole purpose of this class is to show that miracles are possible, and not even just possible, but they are real. And so that this information that we're getting today is going to help us to answer that skeptic and show, okay, well, not only are miracles possible, but let me show you how they actually do happen. And now, what do you think about that, okay? So, before even answering the question on whether miracles are possible, we have to define our terms. So you guys know I'm a Wordsworth. We need to define our terms because otherwise we just wind up talking past each other. The skeptic probably has one definition of miracle that they're working with, and I would venture to say that it's probably not a good one. And we would have a different definition of miracle. So if we were just operating on that premise right there, we would just be talking past each other. So we need to define our terms. Now, I'll ask you guys, what are some definitions of miracle that you've heard of? Maybe we can write some down here. How have you heard miracle being defined?
Supernatural.
So now a question, follow-up question, what does supernatural mean?
Doesn't happen naturally. I don't know.
Supernatural, Okay, doesn't happen naturally. Okay.
So I think of like someone coming back to life, or
yeah, it's not a natural occurrence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or even my Catholic background is like the saints that cry blood.
True.
Unavailable but to natural mortals.
Unavailable to okay.
To the mortals.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that would all fit within.
Supernatural.
Yeah, within supernatural. Anybody else?
I've heard it put, I think, if I'm going to say it correctly, where the natural order is suspended.
There you go. Yep. I've heard that one before. Suspension of natural law. So think of your natural forces in the world, gravity being one of them, electromagnetic force, weak force, strong force, stuff like that.
The sun coming up every morning.
Stuff like that, right? Things that we just see a regular occurrence of. So one miracle that would be like considered here is the long day of Joshua. And there's different theories on how that might have happened, right? But they would say, okay, well, that was a miracle because it was a suspension of a natural law. So I've heard that definition. Anybody else?
Only because in the Bible, I saw the part where God made Pharaoh's heart hard so it could be like a change of heart that no one could believe could ever happen based on people's actions. Like, say, if Pharaoh was really horrible to the Jews in the Bible, like extremely horrible to the point where someone would say, if you could put them side by side, it'd be like Hitler suddenly changing his heart and leaving the Jews alone. And people wouldn't be able to believe it because of so much hate that they had to the point.
So let's see.
To change a heart like that, that for some would be a miracle that they could never expect.
To make it into like a general case, then maybe, so some characteristics of that would be like a radical change
character.
Of character that it kind of almost fits with that doesn't happen naturally, right? So that would include, yeah, if somebody's heart, think of how the Bible describes it in Ezekiel, I think changing a heart of stone to a heart of flesh, that's something supernatural that only, it seems that only God would be able to perform that act. Yeah, good example. I think one more that I had here was just it's a pretty bland definition. It's basically a direct intervention of God in the world. Really, it's just God reaching into his creation and doing something. That's a pretty basic definition that I've heard before. So I'll just say a direct intervention of God in the world. Okay, so now our job today is then, okay, well, we have some definitions here. And our job is to, you know, let's be critical thinkers here. Do these definitions, do you think they kind of take each one by themselves? Do you think they're sufficient enough to describe a miracle? So think about what you've read in the Bible so far and the miracles that you've read about. Do they simply just fall into these categories individually? So let's start with supernatural, meaning is a miracle simply something that can't be explained by nature? Are there any, like, for, so let's start thinking, are there any cases where we think, well, it seems to me that this is a miracle, but it also could be explained through natural means, even though, so it means that even though it happened through natural means, God could have intervened in that step and it still would have been a miracle. Do you have any cases like that?
The fish, the loaf of the fish, feeding the masses.
So you started off with something?
Yeah, just something that would have fed one or two people feeding, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point, good point. Also, what brings to my mind is turning the water into wine.
Right.
It seems that you had the natural means. It wasn't like a, it doesn't seem to fall here. It could have simply maybe just been a speeding up of the process or something, but still the natural laws, I guess, weren't technically violated, but there was a supernatural, can't be explained naturally. So that's something only God can do. So yeah, we have to start thinking about it. Do every kind of miracle, like if you were just take one definition, does every kind of miracle fit each one of these definitions? I don't think they all kind of seem to be saying something different, but it seems it would be better maybe if we could kind of combine them, because I see some miracles that would be here, but that wouldn't necessarily be here. and some that would be here, but not here. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't seem like each of these individual definitions are sufficient in and of themselves. So that gets me to think, well, maybe we just need a different definition. Maybe we need a kind of a better definition. So us as Christians, our guidebook, how are we going to define a miracle? Well, we actually need to take a good look at how are miracles described in the Bible. How do we see, you know, what do we see God doing through them? What are his purposes in doing that? And that'll help us get a better definition, I think. And one here that I was digging through a systematic theology book, and I found this definition that I liked because it seems to cover kind of all the bases here. And I'll say it and then I'll write it. But here the miracle is described as a less common kind of God's activity in which he arouses people's awe and wonder and bears witness to himself. All right? And the reason I think I would prefer this kind of definition is, let me underline some points here. One, it tells us that a miracle is a less common kind of event. So we know that a miracle is a rare thing. It's not like miracles are happening as much as the sun rises every single day. They don't happen on a regular occurrence. They're special kind of events. They're unique. Just like the king's seal, right? It's a unique event. Also, this definition gives us a good idea about the nature of miracles. So the nature of a miracle is that part of it includes arousing people's awe and wonder. So a miracle gets your attention, right? A miracle is not just a bland event that people would just kind of, if they noticed it, they'd be like, oh, well, it doesn't really do anything. Remember, because this is God trying to reveal, communicate to his creation. So this would mean that he's trying to get our attention. If it didn't get our attention, that it really wouldn't be something worth paying attention to and considering, well, what does it mean? So that's part of the nature of a miracle, is that it actually arouses people's awe and wonder. Wow, think of the miracles you read in the Bible, especially the miracles that Jesus performed and the apostles. They healed the sick, the blind, the lame. These got people's attention, and we know how much people's attention they got by reading those accounts. Also, it gives us an insight. This definition gives us insight into the purpose. All right, so the purpose here is that, remember, God's trying to communicate a more detailed understanding of who God is, aside from what we get from creation, which is just the basic understanding. A miracle, the purpose of it would actually be to bear witness to God. So we would know, oh yeah, that was God, and let's say a healing happened. Well, the purpose of that was to show God's power over his creation, meaning if somebody's sick, he's the author of life and death. He could very well heal somebody. So that actually gives us a more detailed understanding. Oh, God loves life. God prefers life over death. So he has just shown us somebody being restored to life or something like that. So that gives us an insight into the purpose of miracles. And notice also that it kind of includes this. It's supernatural because we say that it's God's activity. And this is something that this definition right here, this number three, which just says it's just a direct intervention of God. The problem I kind of have with that is the direct intervention, meaning that, well, really just sustaining the world is a direct intervention of God. We're told in Hebrews that, or Colossians, I think, that God holds the world together. That's already a direct intervention. So to say that a miracle is a direct intervention, well, that's kind of muddying the waters a bit. Everything that God does is a direct intervention. But here we also see that supernatural. We know that it's God's activity. So it's not just something that we just say, well, it's just a suspension of natural law, because this is saying that, well, it could have happened really any other way. But this one's specifically saying it's God's activity, because God is the one trying to communicate something to his creation. All right. So, yeah, it seems that each individually, remember, they don't really make the cut. But it seems like kind of a meshing of the three. And then adding a little bit gives us a really good solid definition on which to use. All right, so it might be worth kind of memorizing or just getting a good paraphrase of this. Because what will inevitably happen is Maybe even this Christmas time when you're talking to your relatives about a miracle that happened, virgin birth and God becoming man, right? Is they're going to start asking you, well, I don't believe in miracles. And one good thing you might be able to do is just start by asking a question. Well, what do you think a miracle is? And I remember having a conversation with my friend once online, and I asked her, well, tell me, what do you think a miracle is? And her definition, I'm glad I asked, because her answer was literally, well, just something good that happens in the world. Okay. So when I'm going to think of all the good things that can possibly happen. Are every single one of those events miracles? I don't think so. That would kind of make a miracle meaningless almost, right? If it just happens. It's just any good thing that happens. So I'm glad I asked. So it would be a good thing for you to ask your friends or relatives who are skeptics, what do you think your definition of miracle is? What do you think a miracle is? And I guarantee you, it'll probably be more likely be this one, suspension of natural law. If they've really kind of done a little bit of studying, they'll probably say this one. But they, again, these don't include the purposes in that definition, right? So it'd be good to get them exposed to a good definition of miracles, and then you can move on from there, okay? Now that we have our definition, our working definition, we can move on to the objections that really have been raised throughout history towards miracles, all right? And really, there's only been two major objections against miracles, and it really started in the 1600s. One of them was from a philosopher known as Benedict Spinoza. Some of you may have heard that name before. And then another one was in the 1700s from a Scottish philosopher named David Hume. Now, David Hume is probably more popular than Spinoza, but for other reasons. But either way. So yeah, these guys really are the ones that raised... They had writings as philosophers, and they tried to write arguments against miracles, showing why we shouldn't believe in miracles or why miracles are impossible. And we're going to take a look at them. And we're going to see, okay, how would we respond? Are these pretty good arguments? Are they really tough? Or how popular are they really? And how can we respond to them as Christians? So let's look at Spinoza's objection first. Spinoza basically argued that miracles are impossible, and the way he defined miracles was a suspension of natural law. And his idea was that natural laws are immutable. Natural laws can't be changed. All right? And I'll actually write it down in syllogism form so we can kind of get a better handle on it. And we can analyze premise for premise. So, this is the way his argument would be written down. Miracles are violations of natural laws. Violations, that was the word I was looking for. His second premise would be natural laws are immutable, or they can't be changed, right? Third premise would be it is impossible to violate immutable laws. And then his conclusion was, therefore, miracles are impossible. If you haven't been with our class for some time, when we went over kind of the class over logic, this is a syllogism. And it's handy because you're able to construct arguments in simple premises. And each premise kind of builds on top of the previous one up until you kind of have enough premises where you can build a conclusion. Okay? So it starts off, and you can kind of see the progression here. He defines miracles, what they are, and then he uses part of that definition in saying, well, we know miracles are violations of natural law. Well, natural laws are immutable. And if you see a combination of these two, he says, well, it's impossible to violate immutable laws. And based on all these three premises, he says, therefore, taking all these three, all the information here, miracles are impossible. Okay, so you can kind of see the progression there. Now, the good thing about breaking down an argument into this kind of form is that we get to analyze each step. All right, so this is the conclusion, the last one. Our job then is to, basically in a syllogism, you say, well, in order for this conclusion to be true, each of these premises have to be true. Okay? There's not one premise that can be more plausibly false than true. So you basically have to take step by step and say, okay, well, let me look at premise one. Is it true that miracles are violations of natural law? And what did we go over earlier? We kind of said, well, that's not really a good definition, right? So that's a questionable premise already. But let's, for argument's sake, let's give them that one, okay? Here, I think the real problem lies in premise two. Here's the one where we can say, you're kind of stretching with that one, where he says natural laws are immutable. Is it true? Is it the case that natural laws like gravity, are those immutable? Can they not be changed? Is that the case? What do you guys think?
Moses parted this.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of gravity there.
And then, well, your skeptical friend would be like, well, that's an ancient book or something like that. So that's
a myth or a fairy tale.
And that would be a different, he would be basically changing the subject at that point.
He was the only one that did this through the...
Exactly. But is it the case that natural laws are immutable? So you're saying, well, we can basically have an example where we can show that they're not immutable, right?
I just can't think of an example, like, in today's day and age, where a natural law is, like, suspended temporarily.
Well, we don't even have to go that far, because what's happening here is, as kind of Lowell was bringing it up with his comment when I was writing, is when I said, it is impossible to violate immutable laws, and he just said, because they're immutable. What Spinoza did here is he just assumed this. And this is actually what we're trying to prove or disprove. This is actually the question that is on the table.
Circular
reasoning, exactly. When you assume your conclusion, so he's just assuming, well, miracles are impossible because by definition, natural laws are immutable. And me as a critical thinker, right, I'm thinking, well, is it the case that natural laws are immutable?
What if,
right? So let's think about it a little bit. How do we define natural laws? So think of like gravity. What is it about gravity that we would think it's immutable? And for me, I like what was written in this book. They gave the example basically of saying natural law, so like something like gravity, it's not a prescription upon nature, meaning when I talk about gravity, I'm not saying that something that has to be this way, that when I drop an object, it has to drop at 32 feet per second, right? Or 9.8 meters or whatever the measurement is. It doesn't have to be that way. When I talk about gravity, I'm merely talking about a description about the way the world works. And there's a difference. And
right,
the way
that C.S. Lewis put it in his Mere Christianity book, he said, it's not really a law, but a description. In other words, if I hold a rock out at arm's length and I let it go, it doesn't all of a sudden go, oh, I'm supposed to fall to the ground because of the law,
yeah.
Right? It just does
fall
to the ground.
Yep.
What about like high-speed bullet trains that are elevated off the rails and just, I mean, that's really, you know.
And those are obeying laws of physics, but when I describe it in mathematical terms, there's nothing to say that it has to be that way. There's nothing to say that those values can't be changed. It's merely I'm describing what is the case. So think of this kind of little quip here. When we're talking about natural laws, we're just describing the way the world is. We're not saying that these things have to be the case. Like,
yeah,
the bullet train is
right.
Not saying, oh, I have to do this. It's just, that's just the way the world is regularly working.
Right, yes.
And the big concept that a skeptic would have to get over is that the universe is an open system, right? To an atheist, where they believe that the world and the universe is all there is, they view the universe kind of as this closed box. Nothing can get out, nothing can get in, all right? So for them, of course a miracle doesn't make sense. Of course it doesn't make sense for a God to reach down into the creation and do something, because for them, their box, their universe is closed. As Christians, we believe that this box is open. And that's worth thinking about. Because what if there is a God, as we've shown through all the other arguments, that can reach down into his creation? It's his creation. He created the box. So it's child's play for him to reach down into the box and play around or whatever, right? So again, natural law is something that God created. Then, so it doesn't make sense for God to be kind of prohibited or restricted by these natural laws. So it's just that this word law makes us already think, oh, well, a law is a law. You can't change a law. You know, that's hard to do. That's just the way we talk about it. But when we're talking about it from a theological standpoint, God is not prohibited by something that he himself created. All right. So that's why we say these natural laws are just a description of the way the world regularly works. But if we consider the possibility that there is a God, then automatically it's possible that these natural laws could be changed at any moment because God created them. So he can do whatever he wants with them, right?
The caveat would be that the skeptic would have to admit that there's a possibility of there being a God.
Right. Yeah, and so that's where you want to get, that's the real conversation you want to have with the skeptic. Remember I was saying, if you can get a skeptic to admit, hey, if God exists, do you think miracles are possible? If you can get them to say yes to that question, you've already kind of jumped over a big hurdle there. Because now all you have to do is concentrate on showing them that God exists. And we have abundance of evidence for that. So you don't even have to worry about a miracle explanation or anything like that. If you can just ask them, hey, if God exists, miracles are possible, right? Well, yeah, because a miracle is something that God does. Then yeah, if God exists, miracles are possible. So, okay, well, let's talk about, does God exist? And you've just jumped a big hurdle there. When you get them to admit a miracle is possible, they might, of course, have a follow-up question. Okay, well, you've shown me that God probably does exist, but you still haven't shown me that miracles happen today. Yeah. And that's something we're going to talk about later on in the study. So these types of arguments and like the cosmological and all that, those are mainly what we call pre-evangelism. Mm-hmm. Meaning these are arguments that we would want to converse with a skeptic who's open and honest about seeking the Lord or God in general. And we use that to show them Christianity is a credible religion. And then now the question after we've gone through all this, maybe, or you can even bypass all that and just kind of get to the point. Hey, you know what? Before I even waste my time in going through an argument, let me ask you this. If I could show you that miracles are possible, would it make a difference? And a lot of them, like you said, would say, no, I don't want to follow a God like that. Oh, okay, that's your real problem. You don't care about these arguments. It's a matter of the will, not the heart. But that's a separate topic all on its own. That's more of a kind of a, you need to put your pastor's hat on and be like, okay, well, let me counsel you on this, right? There's no argument's going to convince you. But for these types of arguments are good for pre-evangelism, for an open and honest seeker who's willing to listen and consider. And so that's the difference there. But yeah, really, again, we're going to show that, yeah, miracles are definitely possible and they do happen. But most of the times people reject it, even just like the Pharisees did. They had miracles in their presence and they still rejected Jesus, right? Usually it's a matter of the will. All right? And so that's what we have to keep in mind, though. These are not knocked down arguments. You still have to deal with the person's heart. All right? And that's where having a good understanding of Bible and God's purposes comes in either way. All right, but before I move on, I know I probably just did a horrible job of presenting this, but just think about this. Natural laws are a description, not a prescription upon nature. They only describe. They don't say it has to be that way. And that was Benedict Spinoza's main downfall in his argument, is natural. He just assumed that natural laws are immutable. And that's actually the question we have. So what's particular, what's interesting about David Hume's argument is that you'll notice that among just your average layperson, somebody who's not a philosopher in academia, David Hume is very popular. I've heard a lot of skeptics, and I've talked with a lot of skeptics who have any familiarity with David Hume, and they'll point to him right away. Oh yeah, David Hume already disproved miracles. I don't have to believe in miracles or whatever. So you'll notice just among the general population of skeptics and atheists, you'll see that they point to David Hume a lot. All right, so let's consider David Hume's argument. David Hume's argument, and we'll break it down in syllogism form again. And this is where he wrote his argument here. It's a pretty old book, kind of hard to read, but it's called An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. And he has a chapter there, about 20-some pages long, on miracles. But it breaks down into this. Natural law, I'll just write NL. Natural law is by definition a description. So he kind of goes a different route. A description of a regular occurrence. Just something that happens regularly, like the sun coming up every single day, right? A miracle is by definition a rare occurrence. A rare occurrence. So obviously regular versus rare. I'll abbreviate. Premise three, the evidence for the regular is always greater than that for the rare. The evidence for the regular occurrence is always greater than that for the rare occurrence. Premise four, he says this, a wise man, if you want to be a wise man always bases his belief on the greater evidence. And then his conclusion then is, after considering all these things, the definition of natural law, definition of miracle, the fact that evidence for regular is always greater than evidence for rare, and then a wise man bases his belief on greater evidence. He says, therefore, a wise man should never believe in miracles. So notice the difference here between this conclusion and Spinoza's. Spinoza's conclusion was, therefore, miracles are impossible. David Hume's conclusion is that he's not really ruling out the possibility of miracles. He's mainly just ruling out the fact that even if a miracle did occur, I wouldn't have any basis for believing in it. And that's where the skeptic kind of thinks that they've kind of got the upper hand. It's like, yeah, miracles are possible, but the evidence for the regular is always greater for the evidence for the rare. Therefore, I don't have to believe in it. All right. And I've kind of just given my answer away, because I was going to ask you, can you identify the false premise? So basically, when you look at these four premises, which one do you think you would attack? Which one do you think you would say, that one doesn't sound true, or it sounds implausible? One, two, three, or four?
Number five? Oh, four.
Four.
That a wise man bases beliefs on greater evidence? Yes. Yeah, I think they're really, they're probably all kind of have a fault of their own, but maybe I would say this. Which one is probably the faultiest? How about that one? I agree. This one is, like Kat said, it's kind of almost subjective.
I'm going to say the third one.
Why?
Who says that there's evidence, more evidence for the regular?
Right? Exactly. I think this one kind of is the most dubious.
Well, you mess up when you say always and never.
Exactly. Yep. Yep. He overstretched himself here. Is it really the case that the evidence for the regular occurrence is always greater than the evidence for the rare? And really, all we have to do in order to debunk, as it were, or show this premise to be false, all we have to do is come up with one counterexample to show that the evidence for the rare is just as good, or if not greater, than the evidence for the regular. So think about this. Think about these examples. A rare occurrence. What is a rare occurrence? What would you say?
Like a
huge flood.
Say like a one-time event.
A monsoon in the desert.
A monsoon in the desert. Okay, very rare. What are some other rare occurrences? Think of like a one-time event, something that's happened only once in the entire history of the world.
Creation.
The beginning of the universe, right?
Yeah.
That nobody was there. It only happened once, obviously, right? This is the only universe we have, and it only happened once. But yet, what do we have? We do have evidence to show that there was a beginning of the universe. So it seems if we were even point to that example, Mr. Hume would say, well, it seems that the creation of the universe is a rare occurrence, so therefore I have to include it in the category of miracles. But evidence for the regular is always greater than the evidence for the rare. So I want to be a wise man, so even Mr. Hume would have to conclude himself, well, I can't believe in the creation of the universe, or the beginning of the universe, because it was a rare occurrence. That's not good reasoning, right? How about another rare occurrence like the origin of life, right? If you, especially for atheists who are evolutionists, right? They believe that there was an evolution and at some point life evolved. So you had non-life and then it turned into life. That was a one-time event.
What about the prophecies being fulfilled over the, you know, over all of these years? You know, if, because of the mathematics involved, you know, that would be an impossibility, but yet it happened.
Yep.
You know.
And all we have to do is show...
I mean, that would disprove that right there.
Because we do have evidence, right?
Yes, we have, I mean, history.
Right. And so that's the key word. Think about it. Every single event on the timeline of history, the moments we're living right now, these very seconds, they're one-time events. They're never to be repeated ever again. So by definition, they are rare occurrences. So the second that has passed from now to now, that's a rare occurrence. And so Hume is basically, the way he set up his argument is saying that that's a miracle, and I'm not a wise man if I believe that history has happened. Because he's saying this premise number three basically messed him up, where he's pinning himself and saying evidence for the regular is always greater than the evidence for the rare. And so that's just not true. Because think about it, another example that was brought up in this book, think of like a hole-in-one in golf, or having the winning lottery ticket. Rare occurrences, we know the odds for like a lottery ticket, one in whatever, 62 million or something like that. Rare occurrence, but when somebody has the winning lotto ticket, do we disbelieve them or do we believe them? Well, when they show us the numbers, we believe them. We don't automatically say, well, it's such a rare occurrence that even though I see the ticket in front of my face, I just can't believe it. No. All the evidence that is needed for us to believe the winning lotto ticket is a simple lotto ticket. That's all the evidence we need. And so it seems to me that here he just messed up. He just didn't have a good premise there. And we can show why Mr. Hume thought that way. Is if you kind of read through his book, through that chapter, he makes a... And there's other things that we're going to go over that are wrong, but this is kind of the biggest one, is that he basically assumes that there are no good testimonies for miracles throughout history. That was his big assumption. He begs the question. So rather than evaluating the evidence for a miracle claim, so say somebody in your family, or somebody in David Hume's family, told him, hey, I prayed over, you know, my family member, and they were about to die, and they got better. Instead of evaluating the evidence behind that eyewitness testimony, David Hume basically just dismisses it automatically. In his mind, he said that he basically rules out the belief of miracles in advance because he believes that there is uniform experience against the miracles. So his thinking was that, well, the uniform history of mankind has shown that there are no miracles. He just assumed that.
They must have made all his debates a load off his mind.
Exactly. He didn't have to think about it. He didn't. And obviously, he's living in a Scottish philosopher. He's just in Scotland. He doesn't have access to all the eyewitness testimony around the world from all of history. How could he possibly know that the uniform experience of everybody in the history of mankind is against miracles? you would have to be God in order to have that kind of knowledge. But he just assumed that the uniform experience of mankind is miracles are impossible.
Well, I think there's a point there. I think that he's professing himself as God, right? I mean, he's saying, I know this to be true.
Yep.
And it's just wrong.
No, yeah.
It sounds to me like he's saying there's no truth in the Bible, because miracles are well documented and witnessed and you know, written down.
Mm-hmm. And that's something I'm going to mention in a little bit. So keep that in mind, is that David Hume, his mistaken reasoning was here, his premise three, but the assumption lying behind this premise was that the uniform experience of mankind shows that there's no miracles. How could he possibly know that? All right. And it's only, and I would encourage you, yeah, try to make it through the chapters, like 20 pages. It's kind of hard to read to, just the way it's worded. But if you can make your way through it, yeah. If you can make your way through it, you'll see. And I don't mean to kind of muddy the waters a bit, but he made some racist comments too. He's basically saying, we only see miracle claims among the barbarians. And he's like, what? You know, like he's talking about slaves. But that's the way he was thinking, is that, oh, we only hear miracle claims from the barbarians, and who can trust them? Basically, you know, that's the way he was thinking. So we know that this argument at least is faulty for that reason right there. So when you're talking to a skeptic, and I would encourage you again, go through the 20 pages, say at least I read it, try to understand it. And so when you talk to a skeptic and they bring up David Hume, you can actually truthfully tell them, have you read David Hume? Have you read his chapter? And so let me get this straight. Do you actually believe this? So do you believe this? And then give them that counterexample of the hole-in-one or the lotto ticket or the entire history of humankind is a rare occurrence. Does that make sense to you? All right. So yeah, that's what's wrong with Hume. And remember, he's the kind of the most popular around today still. And remember, if you remember me mentioning, before I talked about Hume, I mentioned that his, to the general population, to the layman, he's popular. But in scholarly circles, so when you talk to an actual philosopher in academia, nobody buys his argument these days.
Down, right?
Yep. In fact, there's this book.
They're quick to backpedal on you once you've been.
Yeah.
Once you lose.
There's this book by a philosopher that I really want to get. That it's called Hume's Abject Failure, and if you know in philosophy circles. An abject failure. When your argument is considered an abject failure, that's the worst kind of insult. So that's how bad Hume's argument is, in scholarly circles at least. So take some solace in that. So yeah, we have nothing to worry about here. It's just a matter of being able to work through these premises and show which one is false here. All right. So yeah, those are the two main objections that have been brought up against miracles. So one of them was miracles are impossible. And we showed, oh yeah, but natural laws they're not immutable. We know that if there is a God, it's possible that he can reach down and do what he wants. This one was basically against the belief, and we've shown that, well, obviously this faulty premise here. So now the question before us is, well, how do I know when I see a miracle? That's the crazy one, right? And I would venture to say, for all of us, I don't know if you might agree with me, but I think today at least, maybe the miracle is... The word miracle is tossed around pretty freely, a little bit too freely, I think. I think we consider everything a miracle, or a lot of things that are miracles that maybe aren't really miracles. And so, well, so how do we know when we see a miracle, right? And in this book, I liked that they actually had a table here. Let me see, page 210, where they broke down just kind of categories of unusual events, right? So. Remember, they're rare occurrences, and they're unusual, just like the king's seal. They're unusual, they're unique. But what are these different categories that we can break down these events, and which ones would count as miracles? And just, if you want a kind of a summation before I even draw the table or write the categories, all you really have to do is consider the definition of miracle that we had. Does it scream of God's activity? Is it a rare occurrence? Is it something that points, that's the big one, does it point to God? Does it scream of, does it inspire awe and wonder? And does it manifest God's glory, basically? Because that's what God would do. He's trying to communicate to us, but usually in the miracles, especially the ones you read in the Bible, especially the healing miracles and all that, they are showing the purposes of God there. So think about that. Whenever somebody says, oh, it's a miracle, something happened. Well, let's investigate it a bit more. Does it follow this criteria? And especially the ones, does it point to God? If it doesn't, then it's usually in one of these categories here. One of them is just a general anomaly. Anomaly is just something that just happens every once in a while. It might not happen a lot, but it does happen every once in a while. Anomaly. And here they put the traits of an anomaly would be a natural event with a pattern. It's just that we don't necessarily see the pattern on a grand scale. We just see it every once in a while. But that's just really physical in nature. Another word for it would be freak of nature, right? I was like, oh, wow, that's weird. I usually see this pattern. This one seems to break the pattern. That's an anomaly. But if we were to kind of see it over a larger period of time, we would see it's probably more a pattern. Another category would be magic. And not your kind of mystical magic, but really just sleight of hand, right? These are human-made events. So they're unnatural, but they're man-controlled, right? So when somebody says, yeah, when somebody like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, oh, we would think, some people would think, oh man, he created that rabbit in the hat and he pulled it out, right? It's like, no, it's a sleight of hand, right? So that's not a miracle. One would be psychosomatic, and this is really just mind over matter. It's a mental thing. So think of, and this is really, I think, at least from what I've read, been shown kind of on a good large scale where some illnesses can really just be a matter of the mind, where people may trick themselves into being sick. Maybe they're just suffering from some sort of depression and it manifests itself as a sickness. Or some people, and because of that, really some people are going through a depression, and when they get out of that depressed mood, all of a sudden they're better again physically. So we do know that there is a connection, obviously, between the mind and the body and the effects it has on the body. So you can actually make yourself sick or even make yourself well. Think of studies that have been done and they give somebody a placebo. It's not even the medication, but then they get better.
Sugar pill.
Right? And so it goes to show that there are effects of the mind on the body. So that's more of a psychosomatic effect.
I have personal experience with that. I've known someone who, with a stressful situation as a child, was able to develop fevers of 104, vomiting, diarrhea, and went through a whole gamut of doctors and finally arriving at a specialist that said, you know, nothing adds up here. Is there stress?
Mm.
And we found out what the stress was. Don't sick anymore.
Interesting. Yep. So, yeah, that's the type of stuff that you have to look out for. And some people would be quick, oh, they got healed. What a miracle. And I get it, you know, especially if it's a family member, you want to say that this is something big, and we automatically attach the word miracle to it. But the technical person in me, right, is like, okay, let's separate the truth from what we see in the Bible with this is more than likely a psychosomatic. And I wouldn't tell the person that. I would, you know, oh, technically, that's not a miracle. No, it's just for our purposes, when you're talking to a skeptic, you can let them know, okay, what really separates a miracle from all these other ones, okay?
One of the miracles that I just started rereading the Bible,
mm-hmm.
is when God talks to someone in a dream, mm-hmm. how do they actually know that that's God telling them, you know, to do what God has told them to do in the dream? I mean, it's a miracle that God spoke to them, but how do they know? How would they know that really that is, you know, that they just didn't have a dream and that's, you know.
I mean, there's different ways. It usually, I would say
it always works out, you know, as you know, if you keep reading,
yep.
You know, it came to pass just like God said, you know, that they, you know, excuse me, you know, ruled over a country or, you know, had so many kids or
yeah,
you know, whatever the dream was about. But, you know, I just.
I would say there's a few responses you can give to that. When
it's really on faith. They're going on faith that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Instead of. You know, maybe a miracle.
Yeah, yeah.
I suspect that an encounter with a direct input from God versus some random ramblings of your mind and
you
your sleep, that you're going to go, you know. I mean, every encounter of man with an angel in the Bible is profound effect on them. Right, it's not like something. Oh, you know, I mean, you talk to people who are atheists today, and they say, "Oh, I'm going to stand before God. I'm going to ask Him questions or whatever." You know, it's like,
yeah,
I don't know that you're going to do that, right?
Yeah.
So I suspect that it's something that it's undeniable.
And I would say this: as you read the Bible, you actually see different responses. One would be the definite when you see a. Like an angel in your midst, usually the response was fear. And they even thought it was a god themselves that they bowed down, right?
Yeah.
But we also read such cases as like Samuel, where God called out to him, called his name, and he didn't know who it was. And he went to go ask who was it that was taking care of him, whoever was taking care of him there in the temple.
Eli,
there you go. And he asked him, "Hey, have you been calling me?" He's all, "No." And it happened three times. And finally, Eli got it. He's all, "Hey, whenever you hear that voice again, just say, 'Here I am, Lord.'" So there's different responses. And usually it depends on... So for instance, Paul when he had his vision, it was a very vivid vision, revelation, right? And he had a totally different response. He was in awe. He couldn't describe in words, but he believed it. Paul... when he had his vision of the risen Lord, was totally different. He knew exactly what it was, and he said, "What do you want from me, Lord? Or what do you want me to do, Lord?" He knew exactly what was going on. So there's different responses, and I would say the reason that one, it probably depends on where you are in your walk with God would change your response.
Right.
So if you're not really all in tune with who God is and what His purposes are. You'll probably be more fearful at first. But if you're someone who's walking with the Lord and you know, you expect that that's the way God's going to talk to you, you would probably be more susceptible. Be like, "Oh yeah, what do you want, Lord? I'll definitely, you gave me a vision, I'm going to go carry it through." Or it could just depend on the personality of the person. If I'm more of just an introvert and I'm more sensitive to certain things, I might react in fear. Or if I'm a kind of a bold, you know, Sons of Thunder kind of person, I might just be like, "Oh yeah, vision, let's go do it," right? So there's a whole slew of factors that go into that.
Right. So the encounter itself, too, I think is important. Like when Paul had his Damascus Road encounter, right, he was blinded.
Yep.
And then he heard a voice,
mm-hmm.
right? It's very different from having some super...
vision right here, yeah.
Standing.
Exactly.
Yeah, you can't look at it, you hear somebody talk to you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. Okay, I didn't mean to get us off track here, but it was
that's fine. Yeah, yeah.
Something that.
Yep. No, yeah, and it's again.
I thought about that too. It's like, how do you know?
Our fallback should always be okay. Well, are there any examples in Scripture? And like I said, yeah, there's plenty of examples, and I think the examples that we see in Scripture would point to there's not one way. It's just gonna. It depends on a whole slew of factors, but like you said, the miracle aspect of it is actually God. Revealing to you certain information, right? That could happen no other way.
No, I just find it in the Bible, in the Old Testament, New Testament, there isn't ever a time where God speaks to someone and the sign is that they're suddenly bleeding. Is there
that they're suddenly what? I'm
suddenly saying? Bleeding from their hands or their eyes or something? Because it seems
no.
That would be a trick that's not in the Bible, but suddenly that becomes religious. Like it's almost like what I grew up growing up Mexican. Valley and hear lots of Santeria and whatnot, and also like a mixture between Roman Catholicism and pagan rituals. It seemed like whereas there were pagan rituals before, now that sort of God or the message of God was there, that was the common occurrence, whereas in the Bible that's not common at all.
Yep.
Exactly.
So that makes me, that's what
the, think of like
that makes me,
That makes me consider kind of like what you said. You asked, how would you know? And I'm thinking, okay, there's biblical of how God and how it's profound. And then there's man's version of like, look at me, look at me, look at me, look, I was touched. I would say, so you're thinking that might be more of a question of spirits. Who is this telling me this message? And why do they hurt me?
Yep, and that's actually the next category, which is satanic, meaning... no, that's really good, because those can be very similar to what we would think, like stigmata type stuff, and people really flock to those apparitions of La Virgen and stuff like that. And you're like, and it, sometimes it's like, well, being you don't have access to all the evidence, right? So you don't really know. But on face value, you're like, that could be a miracle. Like, well, how do I think about this? Are there miracles that happen outside of God's providence, you know? And to those, I would say, well, we have to know that God exists, but there's also other spiritual beings, angels and fallen angels, satanic spirits. And for some reason that's outside of our purview, God has given them a certain freedom, you know, to roam the world, as it were. So think of like the plagues in Egypt, where the magicians or sorcerers there, they were able to kind of mimic a bit of what was going on. So like they couldn't mimic the lice. They tried to, the blood in the water, the serpent throwing the staff. I don't know how they did that, but at face value, it seems they did something. But I would say there was some satanic aspect going on there. But to help us really discern is we have to go back to our definition of miracle. Where is it pointing to? What is the purpose that it could be pointing to? And so we have a combination. What does the scripture show us? So that kind of gives us a baseline of what can I expect here? Healings and stuff like that. God values these things when he does miracles for them. And two, we have to go to our definition. After I read the Bible and I gather this definition, I have to ask myself, test the spirits. Is this something that is ultimately pointing, manifesting God's glory? Or is this something that's just pointing to La Virgen? Or the Pope or the priest at that very church, or the person who's claiming the miracle, you know? So it takes a lot of discernment a lot of the times. But like stuff like stigmata, we have to question those kind of right off the bat almost, and be like, what is the purpose of that, you know?
I know whenever I was growing up, it pointed to someone who was very holy. So it was almost like the person was like saintly.
Oh, that they would. So okay, who alone has the scars?
Christ.
Yeah. And so to me, that already speaks of idolatry. There is where, why does this person have the scars that only Jesus has? It's by the blood of Jesus, not by the. Why does this guy have the blood? You know. So those are the questions that would be rolling through my mind as I consider these examples.
Well, that goes to me. It's always been when people would say. You know, what is a miracle, and then how do you know this? And I say, well, look at the part where Jesus is healing people in the New Testament. And they go, he's a devil. See, he's the son of the devil. He's like, why would I cast out spirits and the devil's name? I mean, that would go against me. Like, he says something about a house divided against itself will fall. So
yep.
Why would God contradict himself with devil tactics or tactics that seem more paganistic?
Yep.
You know, die on the cross, but then say, hey, look, everyone else, if you're touched by me, it's going to be through only through blood and everyone else.
Yep.
Contradict God.
That's very interesting. Right after that, he talked about blasphemy on the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it takes a lot of discernment.
Chapter 12.
And I wouldn't... It's like when if I were to hear even of like an exorcism or something, I wouldn't automatically think, oh, this is the hand of God. Because I wouldn't even put it out of the limits of a satanic spirit to kind of fool us.
Oh yeah, no.
To know that humans are very prone to be like, oh, where's the next sign? You know, oh, an exorcism? Okay, I'll believe whatever they're teaching over here. I wouldn't put it out of their limits to try to fool us that way, you know? So that's where it takes a lot of discernment in determining what is a miracle, all right? But breaking it down into these kind of categories, understanding the definition, reading your Bible, studying and understanding what are the kinds of miracles used there and the purposes of those, that's all going to help us in being very discerning and figuring out what is and what is not a miracle. All right, so from satanic, let me see, 210.
So, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
What was going to bring up, like, Juan Diego?
Yeah.
That, I mean, I guess that was pointing towards Mary.
Yeah.
That would be, well, I don't know.
Yeah, it was pointing towards Mary. It was mainly to venerate her and how she provided for that village or for that little boy or whatever, right?
So if we're to think about it that way, then that could be like Satan trying.
Yeah, I would say either that or Juan Diego made it up.
Wait, along with the bishops that were there? Well, I don't know.
Right. So again, that's like where we don't have all the evidence. But there's possibilities here.
But then they've done studies like on the feline stuff, the thing that he had.
And so that, to me, again, based on the definition of miracle, pointing to something that's obviously unbiblical,
yeah.
Satanic spirits is probably the next best guess there. Yeah. So.
And it can be in lots of people. There can be lots of them and individual people. I mean, and they definitely work together.
Being believers who actually, you know, that are being misguided with you know, the maybe the magic of it. Or,
yeah, and I'll just add the caveat, you know, we as Christians, you know, you can't be possessed, right? But you can definitely be led astray. You know, think of Paul when he told Colossians 2:8, do not, when we just talked about it this morning in the sermon, do not be deceived by empty philosophy and deceit based on the traditions of men, right? But some people can be, you know, just immature Christians who are easily led astray, led to and fro by any wind of doctrine, and they're deceived. And definitely Satan's spirits can be part of that, but also our flesh.
Well, I mean, I came out of a church before coming to Calvary that was a denominational church, and they were teaching and they were saying the words that were in the Bible and using Jesus' name and saying love and all this stuff. But the message they were teaching was Jesus was not the only way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, and all those people that I knew for over a decade are still there.
Yeah.
They're still in that, right? So they're deceived.
Yep.
Deceived. They're buying that lie.
Yeah, so I would say that would be a case where it inspires awe and wonder. So think of like the common illustration of the rat poison, right? There's 99% edible stuff or whatever, but then that very small percentage of the poison. So it's something could inspire a lot of awe and wonder, and usually that's what we flock to. But then that very small percentage that's missing is pointing to God. But we kind of tend to push that off to the side because we concentrate so much on the awe and the wonder of it that we're deceived that way, right?
The active ingredient was God.
Exactly.
99%
is just the difference between being convicted and convinced.
Mm-hmm.
People are convinced there's a God, so they follow it like, oh, I want to know more, and they stop there. And other people go past that and are convicted unto salvation. You know, they'll just go, well, I'm here for the miracle show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, carnival comes to town. And then have to live the life, and other people are just like, well, hey, look, the carnival's in here, and I want to be part of it. And I think that's what happens to a lot of people.
Yeah, and to put it in other ways, the difference between just the mental assent, the convinced, versus the experiential. You say, I want to go through and I want to experience the love of God and what it means to be a follower, right? So, yeah, let's get through these last two. Providence is really kind of your general providence, like you... let's say you pray for healing. Somebody has a cold, and they took medicine, and lo and behold, they got better. Right? That's not to say. So again, I'm not ruling out that couldn't be a miracle, but just to show that a lot of these common occurrences, it's just regular God's providence, right? God blesses those you know whom He loves and those who follow Him, right? So it could definitely be providence, but let's not put miracles on such a large pedestal that. When you pray for somebody to get better and you notice that kind of there was a long shot that they weren't going to get better, but maybe they got better earlier than expected or in a radical way or something like that. Let's recognize a miracle when we see it, right? Kind of when it's obvious and our sometimes my skepticism comes out in me. I'm like, you know, like it's just God's providence, you know, but maybe sometimes I'm missing out on a miracle when God was trying to provide one. just because I'm like, oh, that could be explained naturally. You know, why does that have to be a miracle? You know, I kind of don't want to give the credit just because of the skeptic in me. But yeah, let's not be too technical in our critical thinking about miracles to where we don't recognize miracles when God's trying to perform one. So it could, these two would kind of blend together sometimes, you know, where general providence, where, you know, you're praying for, I don't know how I'm going to pay the bills. And let's say somebody gives you a call and you got a job or something like that, and you're able to pay the bills. That's a miracle to me. You know, it seems that God provided, but in a way that it coincided with, you know, fervent prayer and stuff like that. Right. So those would be examples of miracles. But other times it might be just be providence. Right. So I'm just that all that to say is let's not to be too much of skeptics when it comes to miracles. Okay. But then we also don't want to be too open minded and let everything in. Right. There's a balance. Okay. The last thing I was going to talk about is, well, do miracles happen today? Obviously, we talked about when somebody prays, and you guys are probably have your own stories of miracles that happen, right? But a skeptic would probably be more like, well, that's not a miracle. You know, that's something that you're just conjuring up that you might have thought that was a miracle, like praying for a job and or praying to pay your bills or get bread on the table or something like that. That's just something that you obviously prayed and you went out and did something about it, and you're the one that caused your own blessing or whatever. Well, let's, for argument's sake, let's give the skeptic that. Let's say, okay, maybe those aren't miracles. So remember, David Hume said, in all human history, there have not been any miracle claims or anything like that. Well, I like listening to podcasts and stuff like that. And there's this theologian, his name's Craig Keener. He actually has a wife from, I think it's South Africa or somewhere in Africa. And he's actually... He's a theologian, and he started writing down a commentary on the book of Acts. And he actually finished it, and it wound up being like, I think it's actually 6 volumes long. It's huge. And he actually, the way he describes it, he was writing a footnote on one of the miracles that happened in Acts chapter 2 or something. And he said that this footnote just kept growing larger and larger. He says, well, how do we know that it's a miracle, and what kind of eyewitness testimony would be needed like that? And just grew larger and larger. It grew into a chapter, multiple chapters, and then let me just write a book. He wrote 2 volumes on miracles, each like 700 pages long and stuff like that. But basically, his idea is that he presents a lot of eyewitness testimony, and he actually tracked it down as much as he could, especially with his wife being African, so he has a lot of availability to that. And we were talking about this earlier. We may not notice these miracles maybe in our nation, but I guarantee you that if you go to like your Africa, your Middle East, your Russia, Indonesia, and stuff like that, you'll have a lot more eyewitness testimony of miracles happening. We're talking about healings. We're talking about visions and stuff like that. Kind of these radical things that you would say, oh, those are miracles. Especially in the Islamic world. A lot of the testimonies of people coming to Jesus from people who have previously never heard of Jesus, you'll see their testimonies of them having dreams and visions of Jesus, and they're like, oh yeah, I want to, and basically he's calling them to him, and soon after they become Christians. And so you'll hear a lot of testimonies like that from the Islamic world, especially in Africa, where Craig Keener spends a lot of time with his family. He goes to villages and tribes, and they have a lot of eyewitness testimony of healings happening. Amputees, people who have been blind, and right before their eyes, they...
What do you mean amputees?
Probably not too severe, but like people with missing fingers.
Digits,
right? Growing back. And not as immediate as you would think, but maybe over the course of a couple of days, and it grows back. Them getting their sight back, them overcoming major illnesses, people coming back from the dead even. So these are crazy, and it's not like he's just like, oh, you heard of a guy coming from the grave? Okay, let me write that down. No, he spent time investigating these eyewitness testimonies to the best that he could, try to get multiple eyewitnesses and trying to gather the stories and that. And what he does is he just presents the information and kind of like lets you make up your own mind, right? But the point is that David Hume is wrong when he said there that the uniform experience of human of mankind is against miracles. Because if he would have only gone to Africa or to Russia or stuff like that, he would have gotten hundreds of testimonies and seen that the uniform experience is not like that.
Well, the thing that stands out to me in the midst of that point of our class is that Jesus went to his hometown and didn't do very many miracles because of the lack of belief.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it says. And I suspect that there's a lot of unbelief in the UK during David Hume's
time. The Enlightenment, especially.
You think it's because those like these countries are like unreached?
It's a possibility. And it sounds plausible.
So I think the first part of what we were talking about in your class is that what is the point of the miracle, mm-hmm. right? And it's to glorify God. It's to, you know, and so these people who haven't been indoctrinated by their schools or their government or their society that these miracles don't happen, that it's doctors that are doing it and all this other stuff, they don't have all this presupposition packed into them. They're people who are living around who know more about the movement and the stars than they do about light pollution.
Sure.
Right? And people are hearing the gospel and saying, yeah, and they're seeing, and the, God is working there because there's not a lack of faith. I believe Americans have a lack of faith. Mm-hmm. I believe the reason that we're not seeing as many miracles is because even people who go to church, who read the Bible, are indoctrinated. They watch TV all the time. They see stuff that's miraculous all day long on TV. And they think, even though it's a movie, right? They know it's fake, but it's, yeah, that's...
They blend it, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. What he just said when I lost it was pretty much that. It's a condition here. It's like something I read about in some book about a Native American in Central Park. He's like in New York, the streets of New York. He's like, listen to those crickets. And the guy's like, there's people walking around. There's calves going everywhere. How do you have time to hear the crickets? How can you hear the crickets? He said, let me show you about conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
He gets a whole bunch of change and throws it in the air. When it falls and makes a little click, 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 people turn around.
Yeah.
They're conditioned to hear what it is that they're comfortable. I mean,
there you
they're
go.
Used to. And to hear the crickets and to hear the little guy, the little buzz or whatever rustling around, that's not what they're attuned to.
Yeah.
So it seems like that Hume would have said the Russians, the Africans would still be those barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
In this Western world.
Exactly. Yep.
You can't believe them anymore.
Yeah.
See, I mean, you hear a lot about... You know, the 40-20 window.
Yeah.
How you? There's a lot of miracles happening there,
mm-hmm.
because they are unreached, and maybe they're more willing to accept.
Yeah, yeah. And so yeah, I would say definitely plausible, and I like to tend to think towards that kind of. I'm not dogmatic about it, right? Because obviously, you just can't be certain. The same thing with like, why did this nation get pummeled by a hurricane? Is it because of their lack of belief? I can't go one way or the other. It seems plausible sometimes, but I wouldn't be dogmatic. I wouldn't go out and be like Pat Robertson, this is why Haiti got destroyed or something like that. But I it makes me think there's something there, there's something to that, why they're more open and why they're experiencing a lot of these more testimonies. And that doesn't mean that no miracles happen in America. Obviously, as we described, there are certain miracles that are the kind of the subtle ones. But the reason I bring up these radical ones is to, because these are the ones that are going to get the skeptics' attention, right? So if they say, oh, well, do miracles even happen today? Yeah, go read this tome of from Craig Keener called Miracles and look at all the eyewitness reports. And you tell me, what would it take for you? What's the threshold? Why wouldn't you believe those eyewitness reports? All right, so that's the whole purpose of bringing up those kind of radical examples.
The book he wrote is kind of like Fox's Book of Martyrs, except it's miracles.
Yeah, he basically gives a ton of eyewitness testimony and kind of gives a theological background to it as well. And it started off as a footnote, right, to the Book of Acts. So a lot of it is definitely eyewitness testimony, and just it's not like he proves. It's just again, he just puts the evidence out there. And just to show that at least the Hume argument about there's no testimony towards miracles, that the uniform experience, he can't say that anymore. So that would be my answer to, do miracles happen today? And that would kind of be the way you would talk to the skeptic and show them. So if they're open, right, they would be like, oh, well, this is new evidence in my court. So if I'm intellectually honest, I'm going to go and investigate it. If they reject it, I would call them out. Oh, I thought you were open and honest about seeking the truth. I just gave you new evidence. Why aren't you checking it out? And so that would expose them right there where they are. You're just being intellectually dishonest. You're not really seeking for truth. You're actually looking for excuses to disbelieve. So it could go either way. Yep, that's it, guys. Sorry it took longer than 45, but...